Hi, everybody. Thanks for that fantastic welcome. Bobby, thanks a lot. And I just wanted to also thank the Chad Summit people for having me here to speak today, because I know that this opportunity is a great one. I'm speaking in front of quite possibly the most powerful audience that I've ever had the opportunity to address, because I know there are a lot of leaders in this crowd, and there are a lot of really, really incredible people in this room. I was at Chad Acadia in 99, and I went to Chad myself in 92, and I know what Chads are capable of. What you people are able to accomplish is truly, truly fantastic. And so I hope that what I say today will have some positive effect on you. So I have a message for you. That message is this: look further. What do I mean by that? Well, I have a problem that probably lots of you share. How many people in this room are nearsighted? Nearsighted. All right. Okay. Blind people, right? Blind is a bad one. I take your glasses off. Okay. Well, actually, by the way, there's actually an advantage to this that I just discovered recently. A girl I know told me she really likes guys that wear glasses, because when they take them off, you know they're serious. Anyway, that aside, when I'm not wearing my glasses, I trip over stuff, you know, I can't see things. I can barely see a foot in front of my face, right? How can you expect me to get anything done? Well, I'd like you to imagine our society a lot like this. Our entire society is, pretty much in the Western Hemisphere anyway, is very, very nearsighted. Except it's not just nearsighted in space. It's not a sense of, you know, not being able to see a certain distance, even though a lot of people are limited by their cultural boundaries. It's a question of not being able to see forward in time. What am I talking about? I'm talking about something called time horizons. The time horizon is how far you look out into the future and how far you can see. And these days, we see a lot of stuff going on. People with very, very short short attention spans, short time horizons. They don't look out in the future. And you remember, of course, there are lots of people on the stock market right now doing all kinds of crazy stuff in the technology market. You know about their companies that are, you know, doing initial public offerings on the stock market, making huge amounts of money, people jumping in for just a short time and getting out. I mean, you've heard of, what is it, Amazon, eBay, eToys, you know, all these things starting with E and I, like iMac, iLink, iPhone. I bet, you know, like if tomorrow you registered iPickMyNose.com just because it ended in .com, you know, you'd make an IPO and you'd make lots of money. But these people, at the end of these companies, they make lots of money. They stay in maybe a year, 2 years. They make their millions and they get out. But I don't plan on disappearing in 2 years, and neither should you. So I think that people should look further than that. And these days, unfortunately, a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year plan is something that's very rare to see, because people don't look out that far. I think maybe there are two possible reasons why people don't look out that far. First is maybe they're too busy. There's too much stuff going on. And the other reason is that they're afraid. They're not able to look out that far because they don't know what's out there, and they're comfortable with the known. Well, I mean, what we're here to do is to push those boundaries. I mean, last night you heard Dr. Bender talk about doing something scary every day, trying to scare yourself to find out what your limits are. Well, what I'm going to try to do today is scare you a little bit, find out what those limits are. You may not believe some of the things I'm going to tell you, but that's okay, because if I haven't scared you with anything I've said in this talk, then I haven't really been doing my job. You and I, all of us in this room, and our children, will be facing, in the next 30 years or so, a tremendous transformation in the way our world works. It will be a radical change. A radical change not only in the way we perceive technology, the way we live in our environment, but perhaps even in the nature of our existence itself. Maybe that sounds a little strange to you, so I'll give you a few examples. World-changing technology number one: genetic engineering. I'm sure you've read a lot about what goes on. There are basically two kinds of genetic engineering treatments that people can do. They're called somatic engineering and germline engineering. Somatic cells are the fully grown adult cells in an organism that is actually grown into a mature being. So, for example, if there's a person that has cancer, sometimes they can do genetic treatments to make their immune system stronger. They make a modification in the DNA of their immune, their fighter cells, and make them more capable of fighting against the infection or taking care of the mutation that's happened. Germline engineering is very different. The germline cell, as the name implies, is the initial cell, the sperm egg cell fertilized at the very moment of conception, before that cell is turned into a full organism. And this kind of engineering, when a modification is made to that DNA, that change is propagated to all of the cells in the organism, not just the cells that were targeted by, say, a somatic treatment. Now, we know how to do this kind of engineering, actually. This kind of stuff is already taking place. If you've been reading the news, maybe you know that there's actually a Canadian company called Nexia in Montreal that has been doing this kind of treatment. What they want to do is they want to manufacture spider silk. And you probably know that spider silk is one of the strongest materials we know of for its weight and how thin and small it is. It is about 10 times stronger than steel. What they would like to do is manufacture lots of this. But it's very difficult to raise spiders. You can't really cultivate them. You can't really breed them. So they would like to take that mechanism that the spiders use to produce the protein in spider silk and put it into an animal that is more capable of being cultivated. This is what they've done, actually. They've managed to isolate that little bit of genetic code that generates the protein that makes spider silk. I don't know what the protein is called. And they've put that gene into goats, which are very easy to raise on the farm. So what happens is, I mean, they have these goats that are, you know, in all other respects, perfectly normal goats. You know, they grow up, they you know, live on the farm, they breed and so on. But they express this extra protein, which they can use, and the protein appears in their milk. So it's very easy for them to collect this protein. If you go and check this out, you know, you can probably read more about it at their website, what they're doing. Anyway, I thought this was very startling. I thought it was very, very interesting to hear that something like this was happening so soon. This kind of germline engineering is something that we also know how to do on humans. We haven't done it on humans yet. No, as far as I know, no laboratory has actually made this sort of modification on a human being, but we know how to do it. And let me give you an example of what someone might want to do. From the current amount of information we have about the human genome, we know how to introduce a little bit of extra genetic material. We also know what genes differentiate the cells that develop into the cells in the lining of the breast that mutate when you get breast cancer. We also know the code sequence for a gene that will generate a toxin that will kill cells. Now, you put these three pieces together. What we know how to do, but haven't done yet, and will probably take place soon, I'll be watching the news, is if you you place that gene that generates the toxin to kill cells, we call that a suicide gene, because when the gene is activated, it generates this poison, basically, and the cell dies. That gene can have its expression controlled by another gene, so it's not always on. So in front of that gene, we put something that responds to a specific hormone so that we can activate it by introducing that hormone, and otherwise it's not activated. And we choose a hormone that doesn't exist in human beings. Hormone from, you know, some animal or you know, an insect or something like that, that none of the cells in the human respond to. So what we have now is a trigger to kill all of the cells that might have caused breast cancer in somebody. And if somebody were given this treatment and they were to, you know, become an adult and develop breast cancer, all we would have to do is introduce this hormone and all of the cells that would have been infected by, that would have mutated into breast cancer would then die and they would essentially be cured of breast cancer. Now, this is also a very exciting technology. We're talking about possibly saving the lives of very, very many people here. And When I you know, tell you the example about the spider silk, maybe you're thinking to yourself, well, that just sounds really weird. You know, I'm not really sure if I'm ready to accept that. But making philosophical arguments about the world in general is something that you can never really have a true grasp of until it applies to you personally. Because once you make, once you, the individual, are in that situation, everything changes. Those philosophical arguments, they just go right out the window. I mean, I just want you to stop and imagine for a second what the situation would be like if it was your daughter that had breast cancer and you had the option to provide her with this treatment. Now, this treatment I'm describing it hypothetically, but essentially what it amounts to is immunization against breast cancer or a vaccine that would be able to save people from breast cancer. And today we would consider it ludicrous not to vaccinate people against the flu or polio or other diseases. And I'm quite convinced, you know, I can't dictate what's going to happen. I can't say, you know, I think that according to my principles, X, Y, Z, all these following things should happen. I'm not telling you what I think should happen. I'm telling you what I know will happen. What will happen is there will be a demand. And this demand has to be met. People will want this cure. Okay. World-changing technology number two. Nanotechnology. You probably know that a lot of things are getting smaller and smaller all the time. We're being able to manipulate things on a smaller and smaller scale. If you've been reading articles in Discover and Scientific American, you may have seen in the mid-1980s, when IBM was able to use a scanning tunneling microscope to manipulate individual atoms on the surface of a piece of metal. And they used them to spell out the words IBM. This demonstrates that they're able to individually control the atoms and position them next to each other. What this will lead to is a technology that will allow us to build machines out of individual atoms. We're talking about constructing molecules bond by bond and being able to create designer molecules of whatever structure that people have decided on, for example. Designing things in the molecular world is very interesting. Things get very different when you're down at that level because you're no longer talking about what we call bulk manipulation. If you are constructing a house, you do bulk manipulation. You move, you know, you get a bunch of 2x4s and all the construction materials you need, and they contain vast numbers, you know, millions of atoms that you're moving around all together at once. And your accuracy is limited by what you can do with the size of the tools you can do. A really good analogy to this is that you are moving around and trying to build things out of a Lego set, but you have boxing gloves on, and all you can do is shove around great big piles of Lego. Well, nanotechnology will enable us to take off those gloves and put on and place those pieces of Lego together in exactly the configuration we want. When you make a bond, of course, you know, you bond two atoms together, they're bonded. I mean, it's not like there can be any inaccuracy in that. They're either connected or they're not. And as a chemist will know, when you connect atoms together in a certain configuration, all the angles are fixed, all the positions of the atoms are fixed. So we can reproduce something by constructing an atomic structure which looks just like it. And when we construct, you know, another fork, we make two forks, you know, they're not the same fork. But if we were to take a molecular structure and follow the same steps to put together the same atomic structure, we don't just have an approximately similar structure, we have exactly the same structure. This lends itself to all kinds of really interesting manipulations. So we can expect to see, probably within the next 10 or 15 years, really exciting new kinds of materials for nanotechnology. For example, when you put carbon atoms next to each other, you stick them, you know, one next to the other, connect them all up, and you have a diamond fiber that we have a manufacturing process for. That one tiny advance alone will make a huge difference to all kinds of manufacturing, engineering, and these new materials will eventually enable us to get into space. The eventual idea of nanotechnology is that you will build a device that will assemble things. You'll provide it with some feedstock of atoms, you know, some atoms that are versatile, like carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen. And it will follow some instructions and build the structure that you ask it to build. So if you have the program for a turkey, instead of having to go kill a turkey and cook it, you can present this program to the assembler. The assembler assembles all the molecules in the correct configuration, and you have a turkey. Now, maybe the turkey is a bit of a silly example, but what you can see is that these devices will be able to manufacture things with very low cost. So not only will we be able to generate things like, you know, food and water to feed people, to provide all kinds of resources that we can't provide right now, we can also use it to clean up the environment. We can use it to clean our water, clean the air, and manufacture things in a way that uses less waste. In fact, if you compare the way we manufacture things now, you look at your factories that are manufacturing cars, they have, you know, great smokestacks with all kinds of pollution coming out of them. You compare that to, you know, one of the most efficient factories I know of, the tree. It consumes its resources from its environment. It's extremely efficient with the sunlight that it consumes. It uses that energy to rearrange molecules into all of the structures that it needs to survive and generates very little waste. That is high technology. That is what I call clean technology. And we're moving in that direction. So you can see that there's a lot of possible benefits to nanotechnology. Of course, there are also a lot of dangers. With with devices that are on the scale of atoms, you could also build devices that can replicate themselves. And devices that can make copies of themselves may run out of control. So one of the common scenarios that people talk about when they're trying to discuss nanotechnology issues is what happens when you get a replicator running out of control. Quite possibly a terrorist who had nanotechnology in his or her hands would be able to produce a weapon that was much more powerful than even the most frightening and dangerous biotechnological weapons that you could imagine. Okay, world-changing technology 3, life extension. I've now described to you two technologies that may allow us to manipulate the way we exist as humans. Genetic engineering may change our genetic code, and very soon, of course, we will have completed the Human Genome Project, which will provide us with all the information we need to change the way that humans operate, to make them more resistant to disease, to even possibly cure some diseases like cancer, or like Parkinson's, like Alzheimer's. Nanotechnology is similar. We can use nanotechnological devices to even more direct manipulation on cells. Let's ask the question of what is life expectancy? When you say that people die of old age, what they die of is not actually old age. Clearly, when people die, they die because their systems are failing. And in their old age, the systems become less reliable. My grandfather, for example, he had a heart attack. He had another heart attack. He had a stroke. Several of these things took place in succession until the complications were too great and the system failed, basically. It's not because, something happens. It just, goes off and suddenly they die because they're too old. It's because their systems are failing. And their systems fail for a number of reasons that we understand. One example is that cells oxidize. We rely on the mitochondria in our cells to process the oxygen we breathe in to generate energy. And those mitochondria, when they're not functioning efficiently, allow the oxygen molecules to escape. And oxygen is a very reactive element and can react with all kinds of other things in our cells that cause all kinds of damage. Oxidation damage leads to cells not functioning efficiently, eventually to cell death, and on a larger scale, eventually to portions of your body not functioning correctly. Now, we know how to combat some of these things. We know how to combat certain diseases, and those diseases reduce your probability of dying at a certain age. Life expectancy is increasing. And when nanotechnology is available, we will be able to make direct repairs in those cells. We'll be able to, for example, repair the mitochondria that are not operating so well, or repair mutations in the DNA more efficiently than our own cellular machinery can do so. Where this trend is heading is that our life expectancy is increasing, a great deal, in fact. Over the 1900s, over the past century, life expectancy in the Western Hemisphere has nearly doubled. That's an increase of something like 35 or 40 years of life expectancy in 100 years of actual time. And the rate of that increase is increasing, of course, because we're doing more research. So we're learning more how to extend the lives of people, people who've been doing experiments on different creatures, for example, know that when cells replicate, they have a counter on the ends of chromosomes called telomeres. There's a certain genetic sequence that's simply repeated at the end of every chromosome. And every time the cell divides, one of those telomeres drops off. And when all the telomeres have dropped off, the cell stops dividing. But there are certain cells that are immortal. For example, bacteria cells don't die of old age. They simply replicate forever. And cancerous cells that are varieties of cells in our own body, they're cancerous because they don't stop replicating. The reason they do so is that they generate an enzyme called telomerase, which regenerates those telomeres. And we've isolated what telomerase is, and some experiments that have taken place already show that if you provide mice with telomerase, they can live up to twice as long. Now, again, we haven't tried these experiments on humans yet, but clearly this is something that people are going to be asking for. This is not something that we can really hold back. You've got to ask yourself when that time occurs, when life expectancy increases not 30 or 40 years in a century, but life expectancy increases 1 year per year. At which point, there is no more need to be concerned about old age. Just because people have always died doesn't mean that they will always continue to die of old age. And I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, people getting killed in accidents and so on. I mean, obviously that will still happen. People will still, you know, people will still get killed climbing on Mount Everest. I mean, that's not something we can prevent. But, and I'm also not talking about the kind of, you know, immortality you may have thought of where people are, you know, 80 or 90 years old, they're living in decrepitude for the rest of their lives. No. In order for them to survive, obviously, all of their systems have to be functioning. And so what I'm talking about is potentially living for an indefinitely long time at a healthy age. And this is something which I expect to certainly appear on the scene within the next 30 to 40 years, which means that I actually expect it to appear within our lifetime. The first immortal members of the human race are among us today. And in fact, some of them are probably in this room. Okay, well, now I'm going to talk about something called Fermi's paradox. Enrico Fermi is a physicist who, among other things, was interested in the existence of alien life forms. Remember from the Take a Stand session that Bobby did in our icebreakers, which was really fun. It was awesome. We were asked the question of whether we think we're alone in the universe. Well, Fermi asked that question. There's an equation that you can try to calculate the probability of the existence of life on other planets. It's called the Drake equation. You put together the number of galaxies there are in the known universe, how many stars there are, how many of those stars you expect to have livable planets, what you think the probability is of life evolving on a livable planet, and what you expect the probabilities of that life evolving into something intelligent. And by most accounts, if you do the numbers, what you end up with is a fairly strong possibility. It's really pretty hard to controvert the possibility that there exists life somewhere else. The universe is just far too large for life not to exist anywhere. So Fermi asked, well, why, if there are aliens out there, if there are other life forms, why have we not seen any? This is known as Fermi's paradox. And the answer to Fermi's paradox, at least one possible answer to Fermi's paradox, is called the great filter. That is, in the development of any civilization, you start with the most basic kinds of life forms, you develop into something intelligent. There's some theoretical work has been done on what would have to happen for every civilization in order to develop an intelligent state. Every civilization reaches a point, you reach a cusp, where their level of technology starts to exceed their capacity to cope with it. And dangerous technologies appear. I mean, we've already lived with the threat of nuclear weapons for some time, and that threat has not gone away. And, you know, even though we haven't blown ourselves up yet with nuclear weapons, it's certainly not been an easy time. Well, that's you know, only one of the technologies we're going to have to deal with that carries with it both a huge potential and a great amount of danger. The great filter, stated succinctly, basically, is that there were lots of alien civilizations out there, but we don't see them because none of them made it past this level of development. Once they reached this level, they weren't able to proceed because they destroyed their own civilization. Now, we may be facing the great filter today. I don't know. I suspect that we will be facing this tremendous technological change we call the singularity within the next 30 to 40 years. For a more optimistic look at what might happen, I would like to bring up world-changing technology number 4, which is machine intelligence. At this point, I'd actually like you to hand out the handouts. But the human brain contains about 100 billion neurons, all operating in parallel. Those neurons are all connected to each other in a complex network of synapses. And each neuron connects to about maybe 1,000 synapses each or so. So that makes a total of, 100 trillion synapses in the brain. And each synapse is capable of firing very slowly. The way the brain works is through a lot of parallelism, but it doesn't actually operate that quickly in serial. So each synapse can fire about maybe 200 times a second. You put that together, you get a reasonable upper limit. I mean, obviously there are estimates that are an order of magnitude higher or lower, but an approximate upper limit of about 20 million billion operations per second. Now, when you get the handout, I'd like you to look at the side of the handout that has the chart on it, the chart of computing power for $1,000. There's a lot of dots on that chart. All those dots represent different kinds of computers that have been developed. Not all of the dots are labeled. I didn't have room to label them all. But some of the ones that you may have heard of, I've labeled. You'll see the chart goes back quite a long time. It's not just back to the 60s. It goes back even before we had transistors or vacuum tubes. And what a man named Ray Kurzweil figured out, and I've taken the data from his book, so the data's not mine, is that if you assemble all of this data on a chart, you'll see that regardless of the kind of technology that was being used, there's a fairly steady growth in computing power. If you factor out how much it costs, and you factor out inflation, and you ignore the fact that we've gone from mechanical calculators to vacuum tubes to transistors to integrated circuits, despite all of those changes in technology, there's a remarkably steady curve there. Now, of course, if you look at the scale on the left side of the graph, you'll see it's an exponential scale. Not only is it an exponential scale, the line on the graph is not straight. The line on the graph is going up. If you look at the dots on the graph, actually try to draw a straight line through them, you'll see that it won't fit. The line actually has to go up. And as of the AMD Athlon that just came out this year, we are ahead of the curve. Now, I've also plotted on that graph a line that represents the number of operations per second that a mouse brain can perform and the number of operations per second that a human brain can perform. Look at where those lines cross on the graph, and it seems reasonable to estimate that within about 30 or 40 years from now, this figure of 30 or 40 years seems coming up. My estimate is something around 2030 is when the so-called singularity is going to take place, where all of these technologies converge. We cross the point where computing power is approximately on a similar level to a single human brain. And now we're not talking about, you know, some computer in a lab somewhere that hasn't really come out in the public yet. We're talking about computing power that you can purchase for $1,000. Of course, there's no reason that that chart is going to stop there. Right? Of course, the curve is going to continue growing. In fact, it may even grow faster than I've drawn it, because once machine intelligences are able to perform the same kinds of operations as the human brain, we will be able to use them, of course, and they will be able to apply their intelligence to developing even faster machines. Now you may think, okay, well, I mean, we don't really know how the brain works, right? We can't actually, we don't have a solid model of consciousness. We don't have a theory about how people think or what makes them intelligent, what makes them feeling living beings. But it's certainly true that we know at the physical level approximately how neurons work. We know that there are neurotransmitters. We know that they fire and they transmit electricity down axons and send signals to each other along synapses. And that's something we can simulate inside a computer. So even if we don't actually reach the point where computers have the same level of intelligence as a human brain in 2030, within about 10 or 15 years after that, there'll be another order of magnitude increase whereby we'll be able to actually just run a physical simulation of a human brain inside a machine. Because at that point, it's all software. And that's the point at which we challenge the definition of what it means to be a person. Well, how can we compete with this? I mean, if this really happens, why wouldn't they just leave us behind? I mean, presumably, machine intelligence, if we're so smart, would just find us boring trivialities, perhaps not even really worth taking care of. Well, I don't think that's the outcome we want to head for. If we head for an outcome of conflict, in this conflict we could only lose, because to conflict against progress is futile. Anyone who has ever... betting against technology is just not the right thing to do. In general, if you try to bet against technology, you will lose. And a statement I believe made by Albert Einstein was, if a reputed scientist tells you that something is possible, he is very probably right. He tells you something is impossible, he is almost certainly wrong. So, what's going to happen? Well, the definition of what we are as people is going to change. It's going to change a lot. But this is not something that we're unfamiliar with. From time to time, people come up to me and they ask me, Ping, how come you're so smart? Well, actually, I have a secret that I don't tell everybody, but I use a brain augmentation device. This device is something I've used pretty much all my life. It changes the way I think. It enhances my memory capacity, allows me to remember more, allows me to think differently. It even changes the things that I'm capable of thinking about. Certainly without this tool, I wouldn't be the person I am today, and I probably wouldn't have even be able to have survived. However, all of you use this tool. What is our nature as human beings? We are the constructors of tools. We are the constructors of technology. And what we do, this is what human beings strive for, is to improve ourselves. Everything we've done, even something as simple as the pencil or the pen, you know, every piece of technology changes the way we interact with other people. It changes the way we think. It changes who we are. And this is something that's not going to stop. So if this sounds frightening to you, or if it sounds, you know, it sounds very different, yes, it is. I mean, it is going to be very different. I have to tell you that things are going to be very, very different in a fairly short amount of time. But the question you should ask yourself is, what's the right attitude? You remember, right? When Laurie Skreslet was up here, he's talking. The whole talk, I mean, it was about Everest, but it was about attitude. You have to have the right attitude to succeed. Laurie Skreslet's challenge was Everest. Now we face this challenge, all of us. It's our challenge, it's our children's challenge to face the sweeping amount of technological change that's going to happen within the next 30 to 40 years when the singularity arrives. There are two approaches you can take to a challenge like that. First approach, very common, instinctive, fear of the unknown. Obviously, this is a built-in fear that we're all familiar with. Right? The things we don't know about, the bigger they are, the more frightening they are. The pure fear accomplishes nothing. Running away from what we don't know about will only drive us further away from our goals. In fact, in the case of technology in this case, running away from what we don't know may actually be more dangerous than not facing up to what we should know. The second approach is to apply responsible optimism. Now, you will call it the title of this talk, right? The title of the talk is not doom and gloom. The title of the talk is not the end of the human race as we know it. I mean, I can't guarantee to you that we're going to make it through the next 30 or 40 years. I have no idea if some terrorist is going to set off a nuclear explosion. I have no idea if some terrorist is going to release a biological weapon that will harm a lot of people or even wipe out the human race. I can't guarantee that. But approaching these new things only with fear will only hinder us. And so that's why the title of the talk is, Oh, the Places We'll Go. Because there is also enormous potential there. We're not just talking about death and destruction. We're talking about the kinds of technologies that can eliminate human suffering, that can lead people to better lives, lead people to live longer and happier lives, clean our environment through diseases, bring us into space, the exploration of all of the vast possibilities of the universe that the human race has yet to explore. So, humanity is about to face the most exciting and critical chapter that you have ever seen in its history. The change we're about to see is something that we have never observed before. I've only mentioned a few of the technologies. There are some others that I didn't have time to talk about, but within the next 30 or 40 years, we will see nanotechnology. We will see transgenic humans, life extension, probably machine intelligence. All of these things I expect fully to happen within your lifetime. Now you have the power to write this chapter of human history. That power is in your hands. Because I know that in this room are some of the most powerful people that I will ever know. And what I'm asking you to do, the most important message that I want you to get, is to learn to cope with that change. Not to reject it. Because change is something that is inevitable. It's not something that we can shut off. You know, for example, when people look at the specter of immortality, maybe it seems very strange that people might live a long time. But that's not something that you can turn off in people. No sane, healthy, happy person wants to die. And that's not something that's even a luxury. It's not like, not everybody needs not everybody needs a fancy car. This is something that everybody could want. Because everybody knows what life is like. So I ask you, put on those glasses. Look forward. Look further. And I ask you to face the future with courage, not with fear. With hope, not despair. Because if there's one thing I can guarantee, is that you will live in interesting times. Thank you. One other note, I brought some books on these topics with me that you may find very interesting. And if you look at the back side of the chart that I handed out, it has a number of references. I strongly encourage you to find out more about this topic, to learn all that you can about it, because the more people that are informed, the more aware we are, the better we'll be able to make decisions about it. The books are Unbounding the Future, which is about the nanotechnology revolution, Immortality, a summary of research in life extension by Ben Bova, and The Age of Spiritual Machines, which is also mentioned on the back of your sheet.